to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And a little later in the show, we are going to be talking a little bit more as it regards some of the things happening in the intelligence community right now, both legal and political. Some about the DNC race, which is coming to an end. But before we can move on, well, that didn't take long. In an order yesterday, Attorney General Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, named for two Confederate leaders, barred from being a federal judge for being too racist. You know who I'm talking about. Well, in an order, he reversed the decision by the Federal Bureau of Prisons to stop using private prisons. That means they're going to start using private prisons. Well, they never really stopped, but they're going to keep using them more aggressively. The original decision was made in August of 2016. Sally Yates, another thing she was involved in, and it followed an internal report from the Justice Department about the private prisons that they were using. The study found that private prisons had more per capita incidents than publicly run prisons in several categories, including contraband, reports of incidents, lockdowns, inmate discipline, and telephone monitoring. The report also notes in a similar vein, quote, higher rates of assault both by inmates on other inmates and by inmates on staff were noted in the private prison system. It's also noted in a number of prisons, inmates are being held in solitary confinement for significant periods, not because they did anything, but because these private prisons were too crowded to fit them in anywhere else. Turned out that the DOJ was also not checking to make sure prisoners at private prisons were getting basic medical services, which is pretty relevant considering the report also found that private prisons had twice as many inmate complaints and that they primarily focused on medical and dental issues. Private prison companies have been touting how many unused beds they have in investor calls in the past week, saying they are ready to take thousands more prisoners of all types immediately, as many had predicted. Donald Trump, who got quite a bit of support from private prison company executives and pushed a law and order message, would most likely take an action like this and expand the use of private prisons. In particular, given that 62% of prisons in the Immigration Detention Network are run by private prison companies, Trump's vow to try to deport millions ASAP seems very likely to supercharge the industry, hence why a few private prison companies saw their stocks spike right after Trump was elected. In fact, that part of it seems to already be happening. The CEO of CoreCivic, formerly known as CCA, it's the biggest private prison company, told investors recently, quote, our financial performance in the fourth quarter of 2016 was well above our initial forecasts due, in large part, to heightened utilization by ICE across the portfolio, end quote. And he went on to say that they were, quote unquote, well-positioned to gain lots more business from ICE. So private prisons are in, along with Blue Lives Matter executive orders. Jeff Sessions starting off his tenure at the Justice Department in a way his Confederate ancestors could really be proud of. Colorado, Pennsylvania, New Mexico, and North Dakota had combined over the past decade an average of 2 oil spills a day due to fracking. That's 6,600 spills in total, to be exact, in those states. Previous analyses had looked only at spills from the fracking process itself, while this new study also looked at the entire life cycle of the oil wells from extraction to storage and transport right there on the site. It found that 50% of the spills were due to the storage and transport of oil being deficient. Also, it found that 26% of spills in Colorado and 53% in North Dakota were from wells where that there had been multiple spills. So there's a lot of bad actors there in that industry. And further, despite the meme put out by that industry, the fracking industry, that newer wells that they're building are safer, newly drilled wells are the most likely to have spills. Part of the problem in looking at these things, however, is that states vary so much in how they keep the data. So despite the fact we know there is a growing number of spills and also potentially significant chemical contamination because of it, we only have enough data to scratch the surface of the problem. In many states where fracking goes on as well, of course, state officials do everything they can to shield the industry from criticism. And it isn't just fracking either. In just the first 10 months of 2016, there were 220 oil spills from pipelines, including one in Alabama where 350,000 gallons of gasoline spilled, so much that it was causing worries about gas shortages on the East Coast. From 2006 to 2015, there is a 26% increase in pipeline spills. Pipelines tout that they have a massive amount of high-tech stuff to make sure spills don't happen. Reuters, however, studied 466 incidents in a recent investigation, and only 22% were detected by the advanced detection systems. Reuters concluded that the technologies were, quote, about as successful as a random member of the public, end quote, in finding leaks. It's also worth noting that 55% of the U.S. pipeline network is over 45 years old. There's that infrastructure thing again. More fracking equals more spills, more pipelines equal more spills equals more poisoned water and destroyed habitats. Pretty simple connection, isn't it? On Wednesday night in Kansas, Adam Purinton, a 51-year-old white man, shot and killed, and excuse me here if I butcher this name a little bit, Srinivas Kuchumbotla, and wounded two others, some friends of his. The FBI has now joined the case, given some witness statements that suggest it was a hate crime. The event took place in an Olathe, Kansas bar. Patrons had gathered to watch a basketball game. There was some sort of altercation between the two men. In the most relevant aspect of what took place, witnesses heard Purinton yell, "Get out of my country!" at Srinivas and some of his friends, who at least some of whom were also of South Asian origin. The owner of the bar asked Purinton to leave for his racist outburst. He did leave, but he came back with a gun, and he started shooting. There was one patron who actually survived a shot in the hand and the chest because he fairly heroically tried to take down Purinton and stop the shooting. Purinton then fled on foot but was caught by the cops. He's now been charged with first-degree murder. I would assume he will probably be convicted, but here we are yet again. So much talk about Islamic terrorism, but the biggest terrorists in America continue to be white supremacists. And those were today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we're happy to be joined in studio on the eve of the big DNC vote by China Dickerson, who's the executive director of DC Young Democrats, and Bob Schlehuber, who has no connection to the Democrats, but is a news analyst here at Radio Sputnik and does a great job in that role. Thank you both for joining the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having me back.
This is a random aside. I didn't plan to ask this, but I realized it halfway through the monologue. China, you were from South Carolina. One of the biggest things on the internet this week and today is the guy in Charleston, I believe his name is Emba, who tried to take down a Confederate flag, didn't really succeed. Many people very happy this took place. He said they did it on purpose because they wanted to show the secessionist party or whoever these idiots were what it looked like to have real resistance to go up against people who aren't afraid. As a South Carolinian, your take on the Emba's flag takedown?
I think it was great. I think the same way that Bree Newsom went to climb the pole at the State House to take down that flag, the Confederate flag, which sparked actually an official taking down of the Confederate flag from the State House. I think it was great that people continue to exercise their feelings about, you know, taking away things that have that are symbols of racism and patriarchy, because the Confederate flag also represents patriarchy and military and warfare in this country. So I was good about it.
Indeed. Well, I just wanted to get a South Carolinian's take on that, given how hot that is. But I just let's turn now to the real news of the day, Bob. CPAC. that's a joke if you couldn't tell. So pretty interesting subtext here, I thought, Bob, in terms of some of the speeches. Bannon brought this up. Trump obviously himself brought it up. Priebus brought it up. They kept emphasizing how Trump was trying to implement his promises. I think Bannon said he was maniacally focused on implementing his campaign promises. And I just – what I really thought of outside of Trump or any of these people was how far our politics really has fallen when there is just no expectation, even amongst people who vote for people, that politicians will do what they say. I mean, it just – that's pretty shocking.
I think it also is continuing kind of the math that the Trump campaign did. They basically said, hey, you know what we should do is we play off Barack Obama not delivering that change that he promised, right? And so for so many years and all of Barack Obama's rhetoric and language, he was going to bring people change that they could feel. And when people felt they were lied to, they said, let's run with that, right? Let's constantly hamper in that politicians lie, they lie, they lie, they lie. This guy lied to you for 8 years, and now what many saw as a third-term presidency for Barack Obama vis-a-vis Hillary Clinton, they could say, you know what, Barack Obama just lied for you for 8 years. Do you have more money in your pockets? And these people said, not really. So Hillary Clinton's the same thing. Do you want those lies? And now Donald Trump being able to follow up on that is quite powerful. I thought the most interesting thing that Bannon had said, and speaks obviously to the Trump administration, but is around economic nationalism and his doubling down that this country will be great again if we focus on the economics of people that are here, and just the lack of historical understanding of this country being built on immigrants, that it's always been about the economic well-being of anybody and everybody from around the world that wants to come to the United States and work with other people that are diverse like them. And so it'll be really interesting to see, as much as they are able to kind of follow through on these campaign promises of building a wall and the economic nationalism policies, if it actually translates into good economic growth, which based on any type of Republican effort, it hasn't led to economic growth when they've tried this model. So the promises are coming through, and it is strange that a politician's promises are actually being enforced. But how far does that go until it breaks will be interesting to see.
Mm-hmm. China, your thoughts on this issue?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. So one, the fact that this country has been built on free or very low wage labor, and though the Republicans continue to say, oh, we need to bring jobs back, oh, we need better jobs, but they are typically, you know, the 1%. These are the people who employ people, and they haven't been paying their people a living wage. So even a living wage. So it's interesting to me that people continue to see them as the jobs people. Additionally, I thought it was really interesting, keeping this similar economic vein, Kellyanne Conway was asked the question about equal pay. Mm. And she went into this story about how she was asked to speak at an event some years ago. I think she said she had just graduated from college. And essentially the coordinator asked her, well, how much was her fee? And she then went into this, I'll have what he's having, meaning she didn't know her worth,
right,
or at least she didn't have a numerical value for it. She said, I'll take whatever he's making. But she's against equal pay.
Mm.
But that story actually agrees with the fact that you as a woman should be making whatever the man is making, and that you assumed that what he was making was the rate that you should be making.
Yeah, well, I mean, let me ask you this too, because I think this is a very relevant question, which is this whole issue of whether Kellyanne Conway is a feminist,
yeah,
or if people are, if quote-unquote feminists are not celebrating her enough as the first woman to be the campaign manager of a winning presidential campaign, of having all these, you know, big positions, of getting to such a high level. I mean, this is just what some...
Yeah, but
if I can quote
China.
Donald Trump, yeah, I'm not the one saying it. This is what people are saying. I'm just saying what people are saying. Your thoughts?
I actually do not... Well, one, the word feminist... Let's not talk about that later. Two, I actually don't know Kellyanne's politics except through association.
Mm.
Because she has never said what she thinks or what she believes. She's always said, well, this is the campaign, this is Donald Trump. And like I said, based on what she said about equal pay yesterday, I actually think that she's a lot more liberal and progressive than she's leading on. Mm. And she's hiding under this, which I don't respect, but she's hiding under this, this is my job.
Right.
So I'm doing my job.
And I guess I do want to kind of circle back too, is we've talked about this before, but how important is economics to people, right? When they do these studies, that it shows that workers obviously want to have a living wage, but the thing that makes them the happiest at their workplace is when they're listened to, or they have a part of it, or they're valued, or they're heard. So as much as like the jobs and economic conditions of people are talked about, when people feel like they're being heard vis-a-vis Donald Trump and his frustrations towards minority groups or immigrants or people stealing their jobs, all of a sudden it's like, man, this guy is hearing me. They're valuing me. They're listening to me. Sure, I might not make more money or that job might not come back, but as long as I feel like I'm being heard and my feelings and emotions are being validated. So I could see where Kellyanne Conway, who's this like master pollster, message framer, doesn't really care about the economics of the situation or the actual money, because that's not what people vote on. As much as it is the economy stupid, it is also, are you being heard, and are you blowing those dog whistles? Are you openly saying these things that people are agreeing to? That's also going to get more votes. And I've talked to Trump voters who don't bring up the economics of situations first, or they bring it up in terms of, oh, I don't want that person on public housing living next to me.
That's
I don't want that person getting welfare. It's more this like individualistic mindset of the American culture that they're really tapping into, that it isn't about all of us working together, which is not we're not a country of collectivism and thinking of the whole. We are a country of self-centered individualism that has worked out in many ways, but I think that the Republican Party is definitely tapping into.
Yeah, I think these people in middle America are actually more upset about, and someone presented this very interestingly to me yesterday, they're actually more upset not at the fact that they're making minimum wage, but that the person who's more brown than them might be making a dollar more. So I think they would be okay if everyone was making minimum wage or having the same struggle as them. But when they see people who they deem as outsiders, as immigrants, as having, you know, illegally come into this country making more than them or even making comparable to them, that's what they're upset about. And so I think we have to be careful. And this is what the person presented to me. When you're trying to reach out to folks who say it's about something you actually agree with, like that we need to raise the minimum wage to a more living wage, be careful that they're not also racist, because now you are talking to someone and trying to help someone who lives in the part of the country that might still not vote the way you would think they would vote if you catered to that one particular issue, because the racism supersedes their economic concern.
Well, I don't know if it supersedes. I just think that the two things are cohabitating. The reality is that the history of racism in the country is so bound up in the existence and the formation of America as a capitalist country. To me, the biggest mistake we make is we try to sort of separate it rather than recognize the sort of original sin of sort of where they both come from. But, you know, nevertheless, I do think that certainly it's, there's a lot of simplistic narratives. There's a lot of silver bullet narratives and, you know, whatever, for the obvious reason. I mean, people are trying to find a way to, like, be the most popular strategist, consultant, whatever, and, you know, whatever it's going to be. And to some degree, I think that is the question about institutions, the DNC, unions, other people like that is, you know, this whole sort of consultant, pundit class of people that it's really like it's a competition to sell something as opposed to, like, a collective process to develop, you know, whatever, the best route to power, the best route to succeed, or whatever it may be. But be that as it may, we are going to get ready to transition here. I want to talk more about this upcoming DNC race, a little bit about some of the other sort of political implications flowing out of that. And we're going to take a break. But after that is when we will get to it here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are, well, doing what we usually do on Fridays, talking about all the issues of importance in the week, doing a little wrap-up, little roundtable type situation. We have with us China Dickerson, the executive director of D.C. Young Democrats, Bob Schlehuber, Sputnik News analyst. And I'll start here, China, with the upcoming DNC vote, I guess. The race is now over, I guess. They're going to vote. They're 447 members of the DNC. And before we actually get into what's happening, I mean, I'm curious your thoughts about this. There's so much talk about superdelegates and blah, 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 blah. It's not democratic, the process. All that's certainly true. And I wonder if this is another example of that. I mean, like, for example, Keith Ellison has like a million signatures. Obviously, this is like a congressional primary. Anyone who's a Democrat, anyone who pays attention to politics, paying close attention to this. And the fact that 447 party chairs, who are to some degree the least representative people for different reasons, get to decide, seems like that speaks to a lot of what people were also frustrated with in the primary, too, that there isn't like sort of a clear, transparent process to engage with the DNC.
Yeah, there was actually this very long back and forth the other day on one of my colleagues, their Facebook page. We were talking about how we as young Democrats did not yet know what the executive committee of the Young Democrats of America, because they actually have a vote, how they will vote, and why we hadn't received phone calls or an email or a poll or something like what, you know, to get a feel for what young Democrats across the country think about who should be endorsed via a vote. And a few folks were saying how, well, that can apply to our representatives. We don't necessarily know because they have these backroom deals. Will they go and talk to Keith and Tom and Jamie and Jamu and Pete and whoever else? And they kind of petition them for their vote. But we won't know until tomorrow how, for example, Eleanor Holmes Norton is going to vote.
Delegate from the District of Columbia.
Yeah. So I think it is interesting, and I hadn't thought about it until yesterday, that we have not been contacted as constituents of our representatives, whether it be within the party or as elected officials, who they plan to vote for. And you're right. I think if we opened it up to the country of who should be, you know, the Democratic Party, like the individuals who should win the chair, you would have a very different.
Well, and let me also ask you this, too, as a follow-up, because in that final-ish debate, the one that was in D.C., the women's club where there was the disruption of Perez, it was interesting to me that Sally Boynton Brown, who's the head of the Idaho Party, and Jamu Green, former head of Rock the Vote, so the two women, they were, like, really, at the end, both made comments like it's really unfortunate that, you know, she wasn't heard. They thanked her for making her her intervention. And I felt like, man, like, this whole thing has really been, like, two dudes. And it's just interesting to me. And it could – and obviously, these are not well-known people. So it makes sense why Tom Perez and Keith Ellison are the two front runners. But, like, for all the talk about Pete Buttigieg – I've started to hate Pete Buttigieg. I'm sorry. I don't even know this guy. I'm not even a Democrat. But, like, this dude is not representative of red states at all. He's a gay mayor of a college town. I'm from one of these liberal blue college towns in a red state. It's – or a purple state now, Virginia. Like, you, that person has no chance to win any statewide office in that state if they are that person. But all of a sudden, he's the avatar. So we're paying so much attention to him. But in a party where the bulk of the voters are women, where the bulk of the voters are people of color, how is it possible that the race isn't just between, like, the two male people of color and the one woman person of color and another woman who's a state party chair? Like, those four people seem like that would be representative of Democrats.
And I think, I mean, it's indicative of how, I mean, we're doing the same thing. Like, the reason we lost the presidential and the reason we lost and I think will continue to lose as someone who I don't agree with, haven't agreed with lately, but he's right, Rahm Emanuel, who's like, we're not going to take back the House or the Senate in 18. So we just need to get over that. But saying that to say, we were wrong in the presidential and we've been wrong about the federal, the Congress and Senate, but we continue to do this establishment politics where it's like if Clinton doesn't sign on or the Obama folks don't sign on, then if the white men, like Soros, doesn't sign on, then you're just not going to get in. And that's why, and I love all of those people, but it can't just be them signing the check.
Well, Bob Schlehuber, I'm curious your thoughts on this, but I just have to add, do you hope, along that with myself, Bob, as an Illinoisan, that Rahm Emanuel joins the long line of Illinois public officials to end up in prison?
Yeah, he'll find himself there, I think, one day. I think it's important to note those, the woman that interrupted the Democratic National Committee debate was asking Tom Perez if he would basically not come out and not endorse any politician that said they would work with Trump, to basically primary every Democrat along the way that says if they support Donald Trump or they're willing to, like, compromise, meet in the middle, taking kind of a Tea Party approach towards, I don't care who you are, I don't care how long you've been in the Democratic Party, but if you're not in opposition, then you aren't going to get our endorsement. And obviously, Perez kind of just big tent, a lot of voices, diverse voices. And if that doesn't show you enough that this party is not a party for radical movement building, I don't know what is.
There were people on my Facebook, including a former leader, chair of the DNC, who said that that woman was out of line. And the police should have been called to take her out of that room, which is super interesting to me because this woman is not allowed to protest. Like, isn't that, that's what we've been doing since Trump has been in office, Maxine Waters, for example. Right. So now that someone's coming, though, for us, we're saying, oh, they're out of line. They're out of order. That was not the appropriate place or way to protest.
Yeah, and looking at, speaking of Rahm Emanuel, too, I mean, the other disappointing thing is the Democratic Party has also showed that they're not going to be radical in any sense of the term. And one place they could easily do it is take one of the how many big cities that they have complete control over and say, let's be radical in Washington, D.C., in Baltimore, in New York, in Chicago, in L.A. Why not just say, you know what, go and support the Black Lives Matter movement in your city. Let's be completely left of left and as progressive as possible. So when anybody criticizes us for being too centrist, we can say, well, look what our party's done in LA. Yeah. Look what our party's done in Chicago. And you're not seeing that whatsoever. And you're having people like Nancy Pelosi come out and say, we are capitalists. This party is a capitalist party after how many millions of people just voted for Bernie Sanders, a socialist. 13 million people just said, you know, we don't agree with this. So anybody that's holding out and say, oh, the progressives need to work with liberals and they need to find a compromise to save the party, well, that requires the liberals listening to the far left, listening to people of color, listening to trans women of color, listening to gender nonconforming people and saying, hey, what should we do, as opposed to the liberals? I mean, this is like Newt Gingrich, who basically was one of the architects of mass incarceration in this country, and then him being one of the features in the movie 13th of telling us how to get rid of mass incarceration. It's like the liberals just lost over the last 8 years 1,030 seats, the presidency, the Supreme Court, the Congress, the Senate. 32 states have complete Republican majorities.
Crazy.
And now these people that just lost all of these seats have the prescription of how to save the party and what to do next. It just doesn't make sense to me that they get to break the whole thing and then tell us how to fix it.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually that's a very good point. And it's obviously to some degree, I don't know. I mean, it's almost like a lot of that. It's so obvious, but it's crazy how they seem to not see it, that maybe they can't see it or they just can't allow themselves to see it.
But we do have, and I hope this actually gets all the way up to the presidential, which is going to piss people off, but it should. I am seeing in the work that I do more non-traditional folks running for office. I do also believe that we need to start primarying Democrats, which is something that you dare not say. Mm. But I think we need to primary Democrats who do not have a backbone and who are voting against our interests. There are still people, Democrats, who will not say whether they will support the nomination for the Supreme Court justice. Like, oh, I don't want to. I don't know. I don't. Like, stand up.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
And just do 12 hours of research and you know what's going to happen. I mean, it's not like these are like super deep examinations of what these people believe. They're like sort of cursory examinations. Well, I think it's a good point that there are more and more people running for office. And I mean, the question of like primarying, I mean, a lot of those people are in safe seats. Like, there is like if a hard left radical communist runs against Nancy Pelosi, it will have zero effect on or negative effect on progressive politics. All that can happen is that the status quo remains the same or that seat moves to the left. So for people who claim like, oh, I want to move to the left, it makes sense that what you would do is challenge establishment Democrats in the bluest places there are. I mean, the Seattles, the places like that, because you might win, which would be good for more progressive, more radical politics. But beyond that, it almost just seems like movements to me in America, the biggest problem is they're all 501c3s and they're all non-political, quote unquote, even though a lot of them are funneling people into the Democrats. But that being said, they don't vote. So you can't punish your enemies. And I kind of feel like movements in this day and age have to show like it's not just enough to make promises, because we know people can break promises. But if you break your promise, you have to know we will come for you.
And we're also not in the same vein as primary now going over to the Republican. A lot of these seats are uncontested. I forget how many seats in Virginia are going to be, they currently don't have any, like, and so it's like, just get somebody. Because if Trump can win president, I mean, Elmo, somebody, like, just get someone to run and let this be a contest.
I know, and these are in districts that Hillary Clinton won, too, in Virginia, some of them, which was, like, totally shocking.
I don't want it to come off as thinking it's as easy as that, right? I mean, it's hard to run for office. It costs a lot of money to run for office. The bench of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, the quote unquote like Elizabeth Warren bench, it's not that deep. I mean, I've been to trainings and seen these conversations where you say, sure, we need to run people, and Donald Trump, not the most qualified person, and hopefully there are people out there, but how do you actually rethink the culture of running for grassroots local seats in America is a big question, and it costs a lot of money. It costs a lot of energy and resources to be able to set that structure and system up. And I don't know if there's a national umbrella that's going to be able to do that to the degree in which it would take to completely transform the political landscape in the country. So I don't know if at the same time, as much as I would advocate for progressives to leave the Democratic Party, I'm not sure if it's the best strategy if they have enough resources to do it and you try to change it from within. I think that's kind of the constant battle and discussion that a lot of people still haven't figured out for themselves.
Man, you better run from that thing like a burning house. That's my advice to you. But, you know, one thing I also think beyond sort of is that's, I think, interesting here, and is how I think surprised the Democratic leadership was by the protest. But the surprise of it, I think, and this is where I'm going with this, is that to some degree, I think we may actually be underselling the political potential of people out there. There is a survey that was done of the American workforce. 32 million people had participated in at least one protest since Trump's election, which is a lot of people protesting. Percentage-wise, not enough people to win an election, but that's not the issue. I mean, you think about if you could get that group of people organized even halfway decently, I mean, if Occupy could change the conversation, if the movement for Black Lives could change the conversation with this kind of momentum, isn't that an opportunity for like a whole new progressive political movement, whatever political guise it takes, to really kind of surge to the forefront within an established institution and its own institution or whatever? I wonder if we just undersell that sort of sentiment, which I think is broadly united. I mean, Bob, you and I have talked a lot about this, about how interesting it was how Black Lives Matter was the most unifying chant at all those initial protests right after Trump. Like, that really was, I thought, an interesting fact. So I don't know. I mean, you look at the movement for Black Lives Policy Platform. I mean, there's just something there.
Do you? I mean, again, this kind of goes back. Is there a national umbrella that's going to take those 32 million people and make it into one party or one giant group? Or did we simply just see 17 different issues bring people out that care about those issues? And so it wasn't, you don't get to count 32 million, you count, there were 17 groups of 1.5 million people protesting. And all of a sudden, when everybody's separated out in their own little silos, and I think in going out and covering these protests, there seems to be more and more overlap. The other night, we were covering an effort by Washington, D.C. activists to divest from Wells Fargo for their support of the Dakota Access Pipeline and their financing of that project. And at the end of that rally, they said, you know what, now just half a block on the other side of the White House on Pennsylvania Avenue, there is a rally for trans equality and trans youth rights after the Obama administration withdrew their provisions for bathroom laws across the country. And all of a sudden, now you're seeing people that care about the environment walk over and support trans issues. Now, if you see more of that bleed over and that crossover, yeah, those 32 million people could be a huge political force in the country. But again, we have to ask questions around resources, urgency, leadership. What is that message?
I actually think that it's a misnomer that I don't think that people don't run because of the money. I think people don't run because they don't think that they're establishment enough or that they know enough people to get the sign on to run and therefore win. I think we need to invest more, and I'll always say this, in state and local races. A lot of these young people who are winning mayors, there's this sister in Detroit, I think she's 20-something now, she's running for mayor.
I'll tell you, that last young mayor of Detroit they had, though,
yes,
that didn't work out. Hip-hop mayor.
But I think they're
no, no disrespect to that sister. I'm sure she's fantastic, not corrupt, and will not have strippers in the mansion partying.
Or being said to have killed someone, had someone killed. But I do think that there are, when you look at state legislatures and you look the young lady, Ilhan Omar, who's now a state representative, I think when you look at that class, these younger people, these people are going to rise up. And actually, I know, just through some private conversations, that these people are waiting to either take on some of these folks who have been in Congress for 30 years or wait for them to die. And all of them are around the same age. Like the CBC folks, and these are all folks who came in together. So you're going to see in the next, I say by 2020, a lot of folks retiring or, you know, unfortunately having health concerns, so they have to step down. And this new, we're talking about splitting the vote, you're going to see some splitting of the vote because lots of people are going to be running.
Well, let me ask you this, China, as our DNC insider here, who is going to win? And predictions on this show come true, so be careful now. You could be blamed.
You know what? Because I've never been wrong about an election. So that's why I'm being careful. I actually don't know. And I'm going to tell you why.
It's that close.
Because
Jamie Harrison is out.
I know.
So can't be
I
him.
Love Jamie. I know for a fact, and this happened with Bernie and Hillary, that there are people who are saying they're going to vote for Tom and they're actually going to vote for Keith. So when it's time to go behind the, you know, non-literal curtain, I think people are going to pull that lever for Keith.
Do you think Israel could hurt Keith secretly?
No.
Because Alan Dershowitz saying he'll leave the party.
No.
I am saying you don't think. Okay.
No.
Wow. So that, I mean, I would say that would be very significant if the party bucked sort of the Alan Dershowitz sort of Chaim Sabin.
There are too many people now who agree with this two-state. So, like, there are too many people who are not this pro-Israel, everything Israel, like it's just not, Keith will be fine. Mm. And actually, I think some folks are willing, similar to Trump, to say, I will ignore all of that, even if it is true, because I just want someone who's not establishment.
Well, I'll tell you this. If Keith Ellison is able to win, will we be able to exercise, finally, this Louis Farrakhan thing hanging over every black politician?
You know,
I mean, if Steve Bannon is in the White House, why can't you have said something positive about Louis Farrakhan? There is no doubt in my mind that Louis Farrakhan has had a more positive impact on America than Steve Bannon.
I will have to pray for Keith every night because he is going to bang his head on his door every day because he realizes that he is just one person and there are other people. Mm. There are major donors. There are other people except for the chair of the DNC that control this situation.
Right.
And he will realize if he becomes chair of the DNC that he doesn't have the control that he thought he would have.
And will people know who people vote for as a secret ballot?
People will know who people will vote for.
Oh, man. Okay. Well,
that's going to be real interesting.
I
think the Israel question is interesting, though, because I think it would be a watershed moment with Donald Trump and Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller and these other white nationalists mixed with a weird Zionist kind of conglomerate within the White House taking on Israel and basically saying there's going to be a one state situation in that region to come. Now, all of a sudden, you bring in Keith Ellison, who has been more critical at times, but at other times he's also been very reserved and very conservative, leaning towards Israel. I think money comes into play at that, and he was trying to hedge his bets to make sure that he wasn't kind of that radical Muslim guy that's going to take down Israel.
And I think Michael Blake, Mike Advice Chair. So if you have folks like Keith Ellison and Michael Blake, who is also no nonsense.
So what's that moment now with groups like If Not Now and other Jewish groups splintering farther and farther to the left? Does that completely re-shift and realign major groups in the United States around Israel-Palestine issues? And it might not just be for two-state, and that's kind of what makes you a moderate progressive on Israel-Palestine. You're just saying two-state. All of a sudden, we might see a much, much more harsh, aggressive conversation against the criminality of Israel, not just that, Israel is a country that wants to be at peace, Palestine wants to be at peace, but a much harsher, critical look at Israel. And is that what ends the occupation on its 50th anniversary this year? That's also an interesting sub story that I think will be covered on Monday.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. And I mean, it's like, you know, for example, if you look at, say, The Nation magazine, there's a lot of support in there for BDS, for instance, in The Nation. Most people who read The Nation are Democrats, which speaks to the fact that a lot of these issues that have been submerged because of this, you know, sort of limited group of very rich supporters of Israel that try to muzzle the conversation, even from other Jewish voices being able to speak, if they're moving a little bit to the wayside here, I think that could be the most interesting issue if Keith Ellison wins. People say, oh, it's not a policy position, but it doesn't matter. He's so polarizing on the issue that he's going to have that bully pulpit, whether he likes it or whether he doesn't.
Yeah, and we'll see if the money follows, if it pulls out or not because of that big-end Jewish money in support of Israel.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that is very true. I appreciate you guys coming on. This Bob Schlehuber, who's a news analyst here at Sputnik, China Dickerson from the Young Democrats here in the District of Columbia. We're going to take a break. Be back with more on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're talking a little bit about some of the legal and political implications swirling around various aspects of the quote-unquote intelligence community. And we're very happy to be joined for this conversation by John Kiriakou, who's an associate fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies and also a former CIA analyst. John, thank you so much for joining the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And so I wanted to start with this issue of Gina Haspel, who I guess now is the deputy director of the CIA, and we reported on this show about her history with the torture regime, and it looks like now she's not going to be able to be deposed or allowed to be deposed in the trial of these two psychologists that helped create the torture regime. I mean, is this really just more of the same in terms of how it seems that all parties involved are trying to shield anyone involved from the torture program from accountability?
Oh, yes. This is a very long-standing policy for the agency where it will invoke national security in order not to allow its employees to be deposed in a federal court. They did this way back right after 9/11 when Jeffrey Sterling filed a racial discrimination suit against the agency. They did it repeatedly throughout the Bush and Obama administrations related to the torture program. And now here we are in a Trump administration, and they're doing it again relative to the suit against the two psychologists, Mitchell and Jessen.
You know, I don't know how you feel about this, but to me, almost looking at this, it seems like this really cheapens a lot of the, I mean, beyond this issue, even Haspel being put in the spot, cheapens so much of this rhetoric with Trump saying, well, you know, I'm for torture, but I'm not going to do it because Mattis is against it, and he's telling me not do it, and we're not going to do it, and Pompeo say, no, I'm not for it, and blah, blah, blah. But then it just seems like when you elevate someone who played such a central role in it, obviously you're doing everything possible to keep things from coming out about what you guys did in the first place. It just sort of seems to cheapen a lot of that rhetoric to me about how we've put this whole torture regime behind us.
Well, I think it just dispenses with all this nonsense rhetoric coming out of this White House. They can say they're against torture and then they're for torture. And Pompeo's been on both sides of this issue just over the last couple of months. But what kind of message does it send when the likes of Gina Haspel are named deputy director of the CIA? This is someone who is being rewarded for her past behavior. This is someone who has been intimately connected with some of the darkest figures in the modern CIA history.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is unbelievable. I mean, it's almost like the people who you thought would never really come back or would, you know, their career would be over or something like that. And now it's as if they are the people who are, I mean, and it seems like, and this seems like sort of in a random aside, but I mean, you look at Pompeo, you look at Haspel. I mean, a lot, I don't know, maybe this is too conspiracy-esque, but the fact that Eric Prince is the brother of Betsy DeVos, I mean, it really does seem that for whatever reason, Trump, his view of intelligence is Dan Coats even, is that sort of the dark operators of the world, the people who like all that kind of stuff, should be front and center in terms of how the country approaches that issue.
And if you look at this historically, you will see that this never works out. This always falls apart. When you have the people who are steeped in the dark arts, let's call it, running the show, things always backfire. They always overstep. And when you have no adult in the room, vis-a-vis the White House, you know, the agency, just by its nature, always pushes the boundaries, always presses and pushes just to see how much they can get away with. So they need someone at the White House, and it's usually the National Security Advisor, who is strong enough to say stop. And we don't have that right now. There really is no intelligence leadership at the White House. And so when you put somebody like Gina Haspel in a position of authority where she can instigate these new operations or order the creation of new operations, and there's no one to stop her, then this is just a recipe for disaster.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's certainly, it seems like that is the case. You know, I'm also curious what you make of this, and obviously it seems like this story is still unfolding here, but this whole Reuters report issue that the New York Times piece about the Trump advisors meeting with Russia was like not accurate, and then apparently the FBI was saying that it wasn't accurate, but they wouldn't say it, and Reince Priebus said it, and then people are saying now that, you know, he's putting pressure on them. I don't know. I mean, it's tough to find out what to make of any of this. To me, it seemed like maybe slight faux outrage on the part of the media. Not the first time, of course, the White House has politicized some part of the government. But curious what your thoughts are about how that played out or is playing out.
You know, I think honestly that it doesn't matter, because if it's true, then at least General Flynn and maybe others in the administration are guilty of violating the Logan Act of 1799. Which prohibits private citizens from carrying out foreign policy. The issue there is that no one in American history has ever been charged with violating the Logan Act. So even if all this stuff is true, that there were contacts between would-be Trump administration officials and the Russian government, I think it doesn't really matter because the FBI isn't going to investigate it, or even if it does, it's not going to recommend that charges be filed. And the Trump Justice Department will never file Logan Act charges against a Trump administration official. So I think this is much ado about nothing in the media.
And how much of this sort of conversation about sort of, factions in the FBI didn't like Clinton or out to do this or out to do that? I mean, how much of that seems like realistic or not? I mean, obviously these are big bureaucracies. I'm sure people feel different types of ways, but like, I mean, are there little cabals that can form inside NSA, CIA, FBI that would do something like this?
You know, I never believed any of that until I talked to an old friend of mine who happened to be serving in the FBI's New York field office. And I was kind of mocking this notion that there were these factions and that it was the FBI that cost Clinton the election, because my position was that Clinton was just a terrible, terrible candidate. And she lost because she was a terrible candidate, that it wasn't the FBI. And he corrected me. And he said, no, he said, listen, the New York field office of the FBI was out to get Clinton. And they ended up doing that because they have these historically close ties with Rudy Giuliani. And that it was Giuliani who went to the FBI's New York office and said, you've got to step in and you've got to do something about these Clinton emails. And they did. And they did it independently of FBI headquarters in Washington. That was just what, a week, 2 weeks before the election? And that may be – that may have been what threw it to Trump.
I mean, it's certainly interesting and one of those things that perhaps it'll be 20 years from now when the memoirs come out where we hear what really happened the way it seems to be going now. With these leaks, do you think that that is – Trump obviously made a huge deal about this. You're tweeting out that the FBI can't find these people. I mean, do you think that is also a situation where there is like one maybe sort of central thing, or is that the type of thing where, you know, whatever, any disgruntled – like is it that new? I mean, that's what I was thinking the other day. I mean, it's sort of high profile, but isn't this kind of always the case that the media is often an outlet?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, if you look back in LexisNexis, you'll see President Franklin Roosevelt complaining about leaks and Truman complaining about leaks. And Nixon was positively paranoid about leaks. So this is certainly nothing that's new. Now, Barack Obama had a very Nixonian reaction to leaks. He was obsessed with leaks more than Nixon was. And, you know, I know from firsthand experience that he prosecuted many leaks, me included. So no, this is nothing new. It's the way Washington works. Usually the leaks are coming from the White House because people are ordered to leak, and that's how they road test potential nominees, for example. That's how people influence policy, by trying to drum up public support or public opposition. But what we're seeing now, especially early on in this administration, is kind of unusual. There's even a Twitter handle called Rogue POTUS, which purports to be White House staff members who are leaking this stuff on Twitter. It may be fake. Nobody really knows. But they seem to be breaking a lot of stories.
They certainly are breaking quite a bit of stories. And the back and forth on that is quite interesting. I'm certainly ready for the memoir to come out and potentially reveal that one. I mean, it just seems like the double standard on leaks is huge. I mean, I don't know this for a fact, but it does seem to me from many things I see on TV and in the movies that the Pentagon and the intelligence community is going out of their way to leak things that make them look good to help people make movies.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Nick Hsu wrote a book recently detailing the CIA's history in Hollywood. And, you know, I thought I knew a lot about the CIA's history in Hollywood. I didn't know but a fraction of what Nick Hsu wrote about. And it's very deep and it's very dark, and it goes back for many decades. You know, it's not just the CIA working with studios to make the CIA look good in their movies. It's actual CIA influence in Hollywood. And I think that's much, much darker, because what it comes down to is that it's propagandization of the American people, which is prohibited by law. That's a law that this administration and the last two have just chosen to ignore.
And, you know, one other, this is sort of a technical question, but I'm always curious about that when people are sort of talking about things happening in the FBI or the CIA or whatever. How compartmentalized are these places? Obviously, there's a lot of classified information, a lot of things some people can know and other people can't know. You know, like the average job, you may know, like, what's going on in Department C because you talked to so-and-so in the cafeteria. I mean, is it that kind of bureaucracy, or is it more like you know the people you kind of work with and everyone else, it's like kind of whatever?
Well, it's both, to tell you the truth, because it depends on the issue. For example, when the torture program was first begun at the CIA, it was only something like a dozen and a half people who were read into the compartment. But then as soon as the CIA started torturing Abu Zubaydah and others, you know, others were brought into the compartment, and then people started talking in the halls, in the cafeteria, around the water cooler, and word got around to the point where within weeks, hundreds and hundreds of CIA employees knew that we had a torture program and we were actually carrying out a torture policy. So in many ways, it is stovepiped, it is compartmentalized. And in other ways, it's just like any great big slow lumbering bureaucracy. Too many people know too much and they all talk about it.
Yeah, no, I hear that. I think that's the bane of all executives at all large corporations. You know, one other thing that I think is I'm curious your thoughts on is this Wall Street Journal story about the intelligence people holding back information from Trump because they thought he would give it to foreign governments. I mean, I don't want to impugn the Wall Street Journal. You know, they have high standards, I know, but that just seemed somewhat fanciful to me that they would just deliberately keep evidence from the president because they were afraid he'd give it to Russia. I don't know.
Oh, no, I actually think you're wrong on this. And I'm proud to say that I predicted this on CNN about a month ago. When you're talking about the CIA as an organization, you're talking about a cadre of hundreds and hundreds of people who have literally spent their entire adult lives at the organization. They've been there 20, 25, 30 plus years in many cases. And they know that they can wait out this president, just like they've waited out other presidents that they didn't like. They didn't like Carter. They knew Carter was going to be gone in 4 years, and so they just waited him out. So I think that's what they're doing, and I think that they see this as a form of not just self-preservation, but the preservation of the organization. They think that Trump is dangerous to the future of the CIA. They don't trust him because of his ties to Russia, or if not ties to Russia, his willingness to engage with Russia. And they think that if they just slow everything down, they can outweigh him.
Well, that's, I mean, it makes sense. I often say the same thing to people about the role of the police and the way they play in so many of these different cities and places is like, you know, the people who are the police chiefs, the institutional people, they're going to be there for 30 years. They're going to develop deep relationships with people while mayors, city council people, they come and go. So how much influence, it's sort of the influence kind of runs the other way, right? Like it's not so much the influence of the politicians on the institution, but how the institutions are able to then influence the politicians.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot to be said about career civil servants. You can't just get rid of everybody that you don't like. It's impossible to just fire everybody in the public, in the civil service whose politics you think are in opposition to yours. And I think a lot of presidents, especially so-called outsiders like Donald Trump, really underestimate the power of the bureaucracy. That's what we're seeing now. And I'll give you another example. Trump announced day before yesterday that he wanted to hire 10,000 new ICE officers to start rounding up illegal immigrants and to beef up security on the border. That is impossible. It's been tried before, and it's not possible to find 10,000 qualified people to hire. And the reason you can't is because these jobs are sensitive and you're going to have to polygraph people. And these jobs, especially when it comes to border protection, attract people who are right-wing extremists. They have been convicted of crimes in the past, in many cases, gun crimes. They're members of racist organizations, usually anti-Hispanic organizations, and so they wash out. The last time that ICE tried to do a massive hire like this was in the 1980s under President Reagan, and fully 50% of the applicants washed out in the process. You just can't hire that many people. And again, this is President Trump really underestimating his power to institute quick change. He just can't do it. because the government is just a big, slow bureaucracy.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And to some degree, it reminds me a little bit just what you just mentioned about the CIA's relation to Carter. One of a couple presidents who've tried to bring in outsiders to reform the institution and sort of gain control over it. Now Trump is saying he wants to bring in, I don't know, Steven Feinberg, I think, some private equity guy, which is, I mean, I don't know what they would know about the intelligence community, but whatever, to do this outside review. And it just sort of seems, I agree with you, a little like naive to think you're going to bring in someone with no ties, no relationship. And, you know, these are people who are to some degree masters at deception in terms of what they do, and certainly masters at knowing of all the different ways to get around things, that you could just come in and change it. It just doesn't even really make sense to me.
Oh, you're so right. And again, this has been tried before. Ronald Reagan did this by bringing outsiders, businessmen, into the CIA in one famous case as the deputy director for operations. These guys don't know anything about intelligence. They don't know anything about the CIA's culture, and they end up self-destructing. It happens all the time.
Talk to us a little bit about what that culture is in some way. I was saying to someone today that I was going to have you on the show today, and I said, like, you know, it's just so funny because John Kiriakou is such a really nice guy. And when I think of, like, someone in the CIA, I guess, like, even I'm thinking, like, wow, this must be some sort of, like, I don't even know, like, people, trolls in a basement or something like that. I mean, like, what is it like there?
You know, a CIA psychiatrist told me once that the CIA actively seeks to hire people who have sociopathic tendencies, not sociopaths, because sociopaths are unable to feel empathy and they pass polygraphs very easily because they have no conscience, but that makes them impossible to control. People who have sociopathic tendencies are quote unquote normal people who are comfortable operating in moral, ethical, and in many cases legal gray areas. They're also able to fake friendships. And so a good case officer will ingratiate himself with a target to the point where that target feels that this case officer is his very best friend in the world, to the point where the target is willing to commit espionage or treason for this friend. That's the kind of person that the CIA likes to hire.
Shades of Spy Game there. Shout out to that. I love that movie. I have no idea if it's relevant, not relevant, but I'm a huge Robert Redford guy anyway, but I don't know how slick he is. I thought was like just kind of so telling about the type of person you would want to have in there in that sort of situation and culture. Final thing I'll say here, we have about a minute left. I mean, with all of this sort of things that have been swirling around Russia and different things like that, I mean, do you think this is going to die down, or do you think this is going to be a meme throughout the whole Trump administration?
I think this is going to be an ongoing theme, and I think in part it's going to be because I think that the Russians so far have played Trump like a fiddle. Trump thinks that he's the smartest guy in the room, and that has led to the demise of so many other presidencies. Most of the time, you're not the smartest guy in the room. Trump is not the kind of person to take advice. Trump likes to brag about his ability to forge working relationships with people just based on the strength of his personality. And I think the Russians are far, far too smart and too experienced to fall for something like that.
No, absolutely. And I appreciate you joining the show. That was John Kiriakou. He's an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. You can look him up, follow him there, and find out all the great things that he's doing and good commentary. That is going to do it for our show here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time. By any